When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in partnership with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. In 2022, the U.S. Mint released the first batch of its American Women Quarters series, celebrating the achievements of U.S. women throughout history. The first set of five quarters included Maya Angelou, Sally Ride, and Anna May Wong, the first Asian American to ever appear on U.S. currency. Katie G. Salisbury takes on Anna May Wong's life in her new book, Not Your China Doll, The Wild and Shimmering Life of Anna May Wong. The biography takes readers through Wong's life from her start in Hollywood's early days, her struggles against prejudiced studio executives unwilling to give her the spotlight, through to her groundbreaking trip to China. A fifth-generation Chinese-American from Southern California, Katie has spoken and written about Anna May Wong on MSNBC, in the New York Times, and in Vanity Fair. She also writes a newsletter, Half Caste Woman. She was a 2021 Jerome Hill Artist Fellowship finalist and gave the TED Talk, As American as Chop Suey. Today, Katie and I talk about Anna May Wong's life, her struggles against censorship, and what films you should watch to understand Wong as an actress. So, Katie, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about Not Your China Doll, your biography of Anna May Wong. Why write about Anna May Wong in the first place? What was it about this film star that made you want to write a whole book about her?
Well, that's a question I've been trying to answer for almost 20 years. I first learned about Anna May Wong when I was 19 and doing a college internship at the Chinese American Museum in Los Angeles. And on my first day at the museum, the curator took me on a tour and showed me one of the exhibitions, which was photographs of LA's Chinatown throughout the years. And for whatever reason, there was one photograph that really stuck with me. And I immediately asked, who's that woman? And it was Anna May Wong. And I'd never heard about her before. And I just couldn't believe that there was this internationally famous Chinese American movie star who lived in the 1920s and 30s. And that no one had told me who she was, and that no one in my community seemed to know who she was anymore either. And so I was fascinated by her. She seemed so glamorous and cosmopolitan and modern. But I also felt a sense of injustice that how could this important figure in our history have been forgotten? And so it kind of set me on this path to learning more about her and wanting to tell others about her life. And so like the more I learned, the more I wanted to talk about her. And, fast forward, I moved to New York after graduation, worked in book publishing. So I started to get a sense of how people write books. And, it's been a long journey, but, the last 5 years have really been dedicated to researching and writing about her life. And I think, why write about her? She was a pivotal figure, I think, in Asian American history, in American history, in Hollywood history. I mean, she was one of the first, she was really a part of the pioneering movie maker. She was there almost at the very beginning. She transitioned from all the different mediums, and then she faced all of these challenges, and despite them, she still somehow was able to make history in all these different ways, having her own television show in the 1950s, making a lot of groundbreaking films in Paramount. There's just so much to me that I'm still impressed by. And I think that others should know about.
So how does she get into the film industry in the first place? It feels like it was hard enough to get in the film industry now. Imagine what it was like kind of back in the 1920s, especially for someone who's Chinese American, not coming in. How did she kind of break into the industry?
Well, the surprising truth is actually no one really wanted to be in the films back then, mm-hmm. because This is a period when filmmaking was still this very speculative industry. People didn't really understand what it was. They knew that they would go to the Nickelodeons and spend like 5 or 10 cents to watch these short, you know, one reelers. But nobody considered it high art. It was like going to a theater to watch a TikTok video. Like, you didn't think that was anything. It was just entertainment. It wasn't something, it wasn't high art. It wasn't something that was, you know, completely worthwhile. It was just a way to blow off some steam. And so no one in the legitimate theater, which is how they termed it, like no one on Broadway wanted to be in Hollywood films. So you have a bunch of people who are kind of coming from a working class background, like Mary Pickford, Charlie Chaplin, Douglas Fairbanks. They get into cinema because no one else is really interested in doing it. And Anna Mae Wong happens to be born in the right place at the right time. So she's born in Los Angeles, 1905. It's a kind of a burgeoning town at that point. It's not a huge city. It's not the Los Angeles we think of today. And then by 1910, you start to have movie studios from New Jersey and New York moving out to Southern California because they realize, well, the weather is great there all year round. So, and they have a lot of different terrains. We can go to the beach, we can go to the mountains, we can film in all these different locations, and we can make films all year round. So she sees this happening as a little girl. She watches film crews set up in the streets of downtown Los Angeles, in the streets of Chinatown. Mm-hmm. They love filming in Chinatown because it's basically free atmosphere. They don't have to build a set, they don't have to do anything, they just use it as background in their films. So she starts watching them and she's immediately drawn to what they're doing, this make-believe world they're creating. And she has the vision and the confidence to believe that she can do the same thing. She says, I'm going to do that. Like I can do that. I can be a movie star. And so by the time she's 11, she's decided she's going to be a movie star. She starts doing extra parts at 14. So she's getting her foot in the door in all these different ways. And, it so happens too, that at that time they're doing a lot of kind of exotic melodramas, where they need people like her in the background, because film is this amazing way of being like an armchair traveler, right? Because you can go to all these exotic places without leaving your home. So all these things are really working in her favor, by the time, you know, she gets her first leading role at 17.
So obviously she breaks into the film industry. She starts getting these roles, but you know that kind of throughout her film career, she's always held back by censorship, you know, the Hays Code and its rules against interrelational relationships. First of all, you know, what were these rules? What was the Hays Code? And then what did that mean for Anna Mae Wong? Like how did that pigeonhole her into certain types of roles, into certain types of categories?
Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing actually is that the Hays Code wasn't really codified until 1930. And so the Hays Code, basically they brought in William Hays, who formerly run the post office for America. He comes in to clean up Hollywood because Hollywood has had a number of scandals in the 1920s. They had Fatty Arbuckle had this whole scandal and a bunch of other things. And so they're under a lot of pressure from the government to basically kind of clean up their films, make them a little bit more palatable. otherwise, the government's going to come in and regulate them if they don't do this. So they create the Hays Code, which basically codifies all these rules of, you know, what is deemed appropriate to be in films. And so they should not, you shouldn't have content that basically lowers the values of the viewers. And one of them is what they call miscegenation, or essentially like interracial relationships. Shouldn't show that on screen, which actually had been a big part of early silent film. If you go back to like 1915 with Sesu Hayakawa, who became a huge international star, a Japanese actor, his breakout role was in The Cheat in 1915, which is kind of like a rape fantasy where he's like the evil but handsome Asian man who's kind of lusting after this white woman. And it was a very successful film, and it like, white women were like obsessed with him. They loved him. So there had been actually this whole history of interracial relationships being depicted on screen. I mean, Anna Mae Wong's leading role was actually in The Toll of the Sea in 1922, where she's playing a young Chinese woman who is essentially in a Madame Butterfly story where she falls in love with an American sailor and they have a baby. He goes away, he comes back, he has an American wife. She gives the baby back. She gives the baby to them because she thinks she's an unfit mother and she can't go to America, et cetera. So they had all of these narratives. But by the 1930s, again, so they're trying to clean up their act. They have the Hays Code. The Hays Code actually, despite being written in 1930, doesn't get implemented until 1934, like, because they were trying to figure out, like, they had to figure out how do we actually get people to follow these rules as they're making their films. Because, of course, like, directors don't really want to follow these rules. But so slowly you see as, you know, Anna Mae Wong begins her career in as an extra in 1919. So by the time it's the late 1920s and early 1930s, she's really getting pushed out of any roles where she could potentially be the lead female and playing opposite a white male who is a love interest. And so this gets increasingly frustrating for her because she knows she's talented and the critics, the fans, even some of the directors also think she's very talented, but they can't put her in these roles because the studio heads won't allow it. Right. Mm-hmm. They're on this mission to clean up their act, whatever that means. And for them, it's like, well, we're not going to give her those roles. So, which we can talk about in a little bit later, but eventually she just decides to take an offer to go to Europe where they don't have those roles.
Mm-hmm. You know, you mentioned the critics, and one thing I was, I guess, a little surprised upon reading Not Your China Doll, which is, you know, the critics, at least the ones you quote in your book, seem very annoyed by the fact that Anna Mae Wong keeps on getting shunted aside. You know, they're always like, they always say quotes like, why do they keep on casting this white actress to be a Chinese character or an Asian character when you have Anna Mae Wong right there who's better? Like, what are you doing? I guess were views like that common? Was it just an instance of like the studio heads underestimating their audience in terms of what they were willing to accept on screen, or were these critics, I guess, did they not really represent what the average American would have thought?
Right. I think that studios did underestimate their audience's ability to connect with an Asian actress. Because clearly she was getting 500 fan letters a week. People would be upset because she'd be cast in these films like Mr. Wu with Renee Adderay, and Renee Adderay is playing the leading yellow face, or with Myrna Loy in Crimson City, and Myrna Loy is playing the leading yellow face. And everyone kind of knows that it's ridiculous. They don't look Chinese. And then you have this Chinese actress next to them who makes them look even more ridiculous. And, but people will go to these films and because Anna Mae Wong was in them, and then they find out, well, she's only in a couple minutes of the film or she gets killed off. And it was a big disappointment to people. And the studios were using her name because they knew they could get people into the box office, but they weren't willing to put her in the lead roles. So I do think that, it had to do with the people at the top who were making decisions because, like you said, the critics, I mean, the New York Times gives her a rave review for her performance in The Toll of the Sea when she's 17. It says, you know, nine times out of 10, like a Madame Butterfly story is like the person, it's boring. It had been done so many times, you know, the person who does that role usually botches it, and she's the 10th performance and she should be seen again more often on the screen. I mean, they said that when she was 17. So clearly people recognized her talent, but it just kept getting pushed away by the decision makers. That is really my working theory, is that mm-hmm. her popularity was there. People wanted to see her. And you can see that. I mean, you see that in what she does in Europe. You see that in what she does on Broadway when she comes back to the US. Even in the films that she was able to make, which were not always, you know, they were sometimes B movies, people love to see her. So I think it is an unfortunate situation. And I think you still see this in Hollywood, right? Where the decision makers believe, well, this is what we think the people want, but they're not actually listening to the people. They're just coming up with their own theory and story of what they think the people want. And in a way, I feel like they were really blinded by their own biases.
So you mentioned she goes to Europe. What happens when she crosses the Atlantic and, I guess, does films in London and Germany? Like, what happens?
So she essentially gets this offer to star in a film that has actually been written for her in Germany at UFA, which is the premier German film studio at the time. And she's 23. The farthest away from home she's ever been is Canada. And she decides, after consulting a lot of people who say, don't do it, it's a bad idea, she decides to go. And she takes, her older sister comes with her, and they sail to Berlin, not speaking a word of German. So she really had some, she really had the courage to go off and have this adventure. But she, you know, arrives in Berlin. Everyone's very excited about her. She works with a German director, Richard Eichberg. And this is really at the height of the kind of German expressionism, the Weimar era. They're making these really beautiful films. And the first one she makes is Song, which, you know, she goes to the premiere in Berlin, and she's mobbed by people. And she says she felt her body float out of her. She said she felt herself float out of her body. The experience was so intense, and she had this like long standing ovation. I mean, they love her. They go crazy for her. They're just like, this person, they're just totally obsessed with her. She goes to a party with Walter Benjamin, who interviews her essentially and writes about it. And he's so charming. This, you know, philosopher is completely smitten and charmed by her. So she really, just, you know, everything that she had wanted from America, she finally gets in Europe. And so she's making films in Berlin. Then she goes to London, and the same thing happens. She kind of becomes this overnight craze. People supposedly are, you know, cutting their hair to have bangs like hers. They're wearing Chinese embroidered jackets, doing all sorts of things to kind of get in on this craze that becomes Anna Mae Wong. And so she's there for almost 3 years making films. She does her first live theater in the West End, doing all of these different things. And finally, you know, Hollywood starts to notice, like, maybe we made a mistake. Maybe we should actually cast her in some lead roles, give her like the star treatment.
So she spends her time in Europe. She comes back. She tries to get back into the U.S. film industry. And what appears to be the final straw for her is the adaptation, the film adaptation of The Good Earth, the Pearl Buck story. And it basically, she fails to get the role she wants, the leading role, Olan, and then that sparks a change in Anna Mae Wong and her approach to the U.S. film industry. Mm-hmm. Why was this film the last straw? Like, what was it about this particular adaptation that was so, I guess, that really sparked this change in attitude, mm-hmm. From her?
So the 1930s started to see a lot of China-themed films being made because there were things going on in China. I mean, Japan was aggression towards China, so there was war. It was in the news a lot. And so it became something that was very interested, that Hollywood was interested in. So they're making all these films, and a lot of them, she doesn't get a part in them because, again, they're just casting white actresses who will play the parts in yellowface. And this kind of goes on. And when The Good Earth comes around, well, first of all, The Good Earth, the film is adapted from the book, The Good Earth, right? By Pearl Buck, who, you know, was the daughter of American missionaries, grew up in China, is fluent in Chinese, is very much culturally influenced by Chinese culture. She grew up in it. And writes this very sympathetic story of Chinese peasant farmers and the kind of biblical travails that they go through, whether it's like drought, famine, pest. And that book, you know, surprising everyone, becomes this huge overnight bestseller. And it's something that Americans can relate to, right? Because a lot of them are still farmers or came from farming families. Then you have the Dust Bowl in the 1930s. So there's a lot of similarities in what's going on in the US at the time. And the way that the book is written, you forget that the characters are Chinese, which is what was so compelling to American readers. They don't feel foreign. And so for the film adaptation, you know, they wanted to give it the same treatment, right? It's meant to be a sympathetic story. You're meant to be able to relate and understand these characters as like fellow human beings, not as like foreign people. And so that was why it was so important to Anna Mae Wong to have a role in it, right? Because here finally was a chance for her to play a character with depth, with a lot of humanity, not the the schlocky stereotypes of the China doll or the dragon lady, always the treacherous type of person who, you know, dies in the end. So it was a real opportunity. It was the role she had been waiting for. There's actually a quote from years before where she says, you know, one day someone's going to make a sympathetic part for a Chinese actress. And that, so that day came, it was The Good Earth. And of course, you know, Hollywood essentially found a way not to cast her. I mean, of course, everyone, the press, the critics were all like, oh, well, who should play this role? It should be Anna May Wong, obviously. Like, who, what other Chinese actress do you know? And instead they cast Paul Muni in the role of Wong Lung, who's the male lead. And so therefore they use that as a way of saying, well, we can't cast an Asian woman to play Olan now because now there's a white male lead, even though they're supposed to be playing Chinese people, right? So there isn't really an interracial component if they're both supposed to be Chinese. But anyways, nonetheless, they say, well, sorry, we can't cast you. Then they make her go through this whole auditioning process to audition for a smaller supporting role of Lotus, again, another Lotus Blossom part, who is essentially like the second wife or the tea house girl who seduces Wong Lung and gets him to marry her as the second wife, the one unsympathetic role. In the end, it turns out they don't even offer her that role. They actually offer her an even smaller role, the lady in waiting to Lotus. So this whole experience was very insulting for Anna May Wong. And, but she came up with a brilliant way to respond to it, which was, to say publicly, she says, well, I'm not going to take the Lotus role, even though it had not been offered to her, but no one knows that, right? She says, I'm not going to take this role because they're asking me as the Chinese American actress to play the one unsympathetic part in this entire film that's meant to be sympathetic to the Chinese. So I won't do it because, you know, the subtext is that's racist. And in fact, if you really want to see China, I am going to China for the first time in my life. And I'm bringing a cameraman with me who's going to document my travels, which she later makes into a documentary that she narrates. She also is planning to write a series of articles for the New York Herald Tribune that then gets syndicated across the country about her experiences there. So she has this kind of whole counter programming that she comes up with to not only have this incredible experience for herself, but to take other Americans along with her, because she, you know, they'll be experiencing the same thing she is for the first time, what China is really like versus this Hollywood concocted version of China.
So I do want to talk about her trip to China, but before we move there, I do want to talk about the Good Earth, the film, because, you know, in spite of the studio meddling, in spite of the casting controversy, it certainly seems like the Chinese American community really wanted to support the film. They thought it was great. The actors involved, particularly Paul Muni, seem to have made a pretty good faith effort to try and reflect the culture and characters as best they could. And so I guess, I mean, with that in mind, I mean, how do you see, like, the people, like, how do people at the time, whether Chinese American communities, actors who maybe were sympathetic to these questions about representation and cultural appropriation, how, like, what did they try to do in viewing the film and in approaching this film, despite all of the casting controversy around it?
So, you know, for Anna May Wong, she wanted to be a part of that film, right? And she couldn't in the end. So I think that everyone, it makes sense that everyone in the Chinese American community wanted to be a part of it. They had read the book. They loved the book. They loved the way that it represented them in a different light to other Americans. So it was definitely a sense of like, this is a really positive thing for our community that we should be a part of. And granted, there are limitations to, you know, they weren't the ones calling the shots or making decisions about how the film would be made, but they could still be in it. And it was also a boon for a lot of working class people in Chinatown, right? Because they could get jobs. I mean, The Good Earth probably employed like 3,000 Chinese Americans in all different capacities. Like they were farmers. I mean, and when I say farmers, they weren't just playing farmers. They were literally farming the land for MGM to make it look like a working farm. You know, they were doing all sorts of things on set. They also, you know, they would get meals every day as part of it. So it was a fun experience. It's probably easier work than a lot of things they could have been doing, whether it was like working in a restaurant or in a laundry, right? Because mostly on set, if you're not on camera, you're just sitting around all day. So they play cards, they do all sorts of things. So it was definitely, it was financially, economically helpful to everyone in the community because it was giving them a living wage, but it was also a chance to be a part of, in a way, part of history, right? This was supposed to be a historic film. I think, and this is also one of the reasons I spend so much time on it in the book, because, you know, you could say like, well, why are you writing about a film that Anne Wong's not even in? And, you know, there's a bunch of different reasons for that. I mean, part of it is that I think you need to understand that film because it's such a big, it looms so large in her story, whether she's in it or not. But the other part is to see how Hollywood made films about the Chinese or about Asian themed topics with Chinese, but also without us. Like we're in it, but we're not, you know, making decisions. And just the whole, I mean, the irony of the fact that they wanted to make this film so to be like the most authentic film it could be, right? There's such a because they understand the importance of the book and the story, they want to make it this very genuine attempt at telling it, right? So they bought up, you know, farms from China, which they then ship back to Los Angeles and recreate. They're doing all these things. I mean, I've been through the production files at the Academy Library. I mean, they have photos of all these different Chinese hairstyles, like how to do the different hairstyles depending on like what your station in life is. So they're the minutia of the detail. I mean, it's just, it's kind of insane. And yet they couldn't bring themselves to cast Asian
actors. Like a Chinese American. Yeah.
Yeah. They just couldn't do it. I mean, the racism that's that the implicit racism that is part of that, that they can't even see it. I mean, it's fascinating to me.
So Anna May Wong, she goes to China. How does that first trip go? You note in the book that the Chinese press were not always super happy with Anna May Wong because of the roles that she played. There was some controversy when she got to some places in China, but like how did this first trip to China go?
Well, so it was actually her only trip to China. Mm-hmm. So first and last, unfortunately. But yeah, I mean, I like her life. It was filled with a lot of ups and downs. I think on the one hand, you know, she gets this incredible welcome when she arrives in Shanghai, and she is assuming that people in China aren't really going to know who she is. I don't know why she assumes that, but she assumes that. I mean, you would have no way to really know in that time. So she thinks, oh, well, no one's going to know who I am, and I'm just going to have this like quiet, you know, getaway to China for this year. And she arrives and it's the complete opposite, right? The dock is mobbed with people. She has to exit through a side door just to get out of there. So it's this kind of very exciting thing where people really, like, she actually means something to them. But what comes with that is a lot of expectations, right? She's not like a normal American movie star. She's Chinese. So they expect a lot more from her, right? They expect her, you know, even though she's never been to China, they expect her to understand the culture. They expect her to live up to certain values that they might have. You know, her Chinese isn't the best. She speaks, she grew up speaking kind of toy Sunnese at home, and she doesn't, you know, most people can't really understand her outside of her family. So she's in a way this perplexing woman. And, you know, there are also some people are predisposed to dislike her, right? As you mentioned, like a lot of people weren't happy with the role she played, not understanding what the situation was for her, right? They don't understand that she didn't get to choose her roles, that she's like the only Chinese American actress, that there's a lot of racial bias in the US, which is why she has to play these roles. So there's a lot of misunderstanding there. And yeah, so when she actually goes further south to Hong Kong, she has a very bad reception there. So this is, so Hong Kong is a lot closer to where she's from, right? She's Cantonese. So, expectations are even higher. And she gets off this boat and not knowing, doesn't recognize maybe some important people from the local film industry. And that pisses them off, pisses off the entire crowd. You know, they suddenly go from, you know, happy to see her to filled with rage. They destroy all the flowers that were brought for her. They shout down with Wang Liuzhong. That's her Chinese name. And it's a terrible incident. And she kind of has to lay low. She takes a trip to the Philippines to kind of get away from the bad press. And then has to sneak into Toisan to visit her father's village at some point, because the whole ancestral group has said, well, we're not going to, well, you know, we'll deport you if you come here. So yeah, there's a lot of tension. And then the kind of cherry on top is she has to sit through this state dinner with the nationalist government. And they basically spend like hours criticizing her for all the roles she's played. And, you know, she puts up with all of this. And in spite of the criticism, she really takes a lot of what they're saying to heart, because she begins to understand like that, well, people, and not only do people in China know her, but they do feel in a way represented by her in Western culture. And so whether she likes it or not, she is a kind of symbolic representative of them, right? I mean, it's ridiculous to think that one person could represent all Chinese people everywhere. I mean, that's completely absurd. But that was kind of the situation for her. And so knowing that, and also having this experience in China where she's learning so much more about her culture, she's visiting places she's only heard about in stories. Mm-hmm. When she goes back to Hollywood, she decides, I'm not going to play any more unsympathetic roles that make my people look bad. And that's like she draws a hard line in the sand. And so you see a marked difference in the types of films she ends up doing. I mean, granted, the next series of films are all B movies, but she has a lot more control over them. And the stories are in many ways groundbreaking. So that trip really changed her life in so many ways.
And, you know, it's an early version of something we know today or see today, where, you know, you have second generation, third generation Americans who go back and rediscover the place that their parents or grandparents or even earlier descendants left. This happens with Asian Americans. It happens with African Americans. Happens with a lot of minorities in America. Do you see that? I mean, I guess, how do you see kind of that connection between the trip that Anna Mae Wong made and, I guess, similar impulses amongst Americans today?
I think it's very similar. I think, you know, she, especially for her growing up in an era when people didn't understand what it meant to be like a hyphenated American, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't really know what Chinese American was to be, that you could be both. Because there's so many articles, interviews with her where they describe her as this China doll, this and that, blah, blah, blah. She's like a ancient Chinese poem. And then she speaks and she's totally American. And they're, you know, it's completely unexpected to them. They've never experienced someone who's like that, who speaks in the flapper slang and is very chic and cool and just like them, but somehow Chinese. And so.
Oh, that's right. I think, was it one British review that suddenly, like, she sounds like an American on stage? It's really annoying. And it's just like, and it's like a straight, I know she tries so hard to escape the being only typecast as Chinese. And then suddenly she's like, oh, she's far too American.
Right, right. When she makes her stage debut in London, yeah, they can't stand her American accent. And it's like, well, she doesn't seem very Chinese. And it's like, well, how was she supposed to seem Chinese speaking English, right? You know, like, what was she supposed to sound like? Yeah, you have this yearning within herself to understand where she came from, right? Because everyone sees her one way. She feels American. I mean, she does feel Chinese as well. She feels Chinese in the way that she's grown up in a Chinese family, but she doesn't know all of the culture that her, you know, family has come from. And, you know, you see this a lot through some of the interviews. She talks about how she's reading Confucius's Analects or reading Laozi. Like, she's really trying to explore, and she's looking for something, you know, she's searching for her own identity and heritage through a lot of these things. So I think China, being able to go there and take that trip, was a very fulfilling experience for her. And, you know, I've watched the documentary that she made, which is held at the UCLA TV Film and TV Archives. And it's a really beautiful film. And I think this just goes back to your question, because I myself have, you know, I'm fifth generation Chinese American. And, you know, my mom doesn't speak Chinese. but I studied Mandarin in college. And I've gone back to China a number of times. And the last trip I took was actually to finally go to southern China and to visit my grandma's ancestral village. And that experience was deeply moving for me. And then watching Anna May Wong's documentary, I saw her having that same experience. And her father was living there at the time. And you see her, they're walking arm in arm. And there's like the rice paddies in the distance. And it echoed my own experience so much. It was just really moving. And I think it's a very similar thing that we're talking about. Like, she was searching for her own identity and her heritage and her, what it meant to be Chinese, because a lot of us, we don't grow up with that. Like, we feel divorced from the original culture that our families came from.
So I guess final question, and I guess it's more of a recommendation for listeners. You wrote about Anna May Wong for this biography. You had to watch all of her movies. What film should someone watch if they really wanted to know what Anna May Wong was like on screen?
I will say it's really difficult to recommend only one film.
You can recommend several. It's okay. People have time.
Recommend several? Okay. Because also, you know, I love a lot of her silent films. Silent films are not for everyone. Mm-hmm. But I would say you could start with The Toll of the Sea, which actually it was made in Technicolor. So that's actually pretty interesting to see it in color, which is the film she made at 17. And she gives this virtuoso performance that then is, you know, reviewed by the New York Times. It's a great one. There's also another silent film that she made in Germany that was recently restored and digitized called Pavement Butterfly. And it is really, it's one of her top five, if not like the top film that she's ever made. It's beautiful and it's available on YouTube. So I would highly recommend that one. And then if you're more into sound films, I'll limit myself to two more. Shanghai Express is always a great watch. It's with Marlene Dietrich, directed by Joseph von Sternberg. It's a great film. I've watched it so many times. It's really funny. Anna May Wong is great in it. My only complaint is there's just not enough of her, because it really is a film for Marlene Dietrich. And then the other film I recommend is the first film she made when she came back from China, which is called Daughter of Shanghai. And it's a kind of crime thriller film where she and Philip Ahn, who's a Korean American actor, play the heroes essentially. And they're also like a leading romantic couple, which is, makes it the first time in film history that you have a leading romantic couple played by Asian American actors in the sound era. So it's just that film. I mean, it's a B movie. It's a bit of a melodrama, but it's actually really fun to watch. I recently watched it with an audience in New York, and you never know how people are going to respond to things, but they seem to love it. It was really fun and funny. So I would definitely recommend that film.
It's really great you mentioned Shanghai Express, because I'm going to use this opportunity now to plug a few earlier interviews we've done on the show, which is, Shanghai Express is based very, very loosely based off the Lin Cheng incident, which is the topic of James Zimmerman's The Peking Express, which we interviewed last year. Another book that I should plug as well is, or another author is Susan Blumberg-Kaysen, who wrote a biography of Bernardine Sold Fritz, who was a confidant of Anna May Wong during her time in Shanghai and in Los Angeles. I know you've talked with Susan. I just kind of maybe talk a little about Anna May Wong's relationship with Bernardine Sold Fritz.
Yeah, so the two women became good friends during Anna May Wong's time in China. So in a way, Bernardine could be a kind of guide to her because she introduced her to a lot of different people in both the expat community, but also kind of the elite Chinese circles at the time, like Lin Yutang and Harold Acton. So she really made Anna May Wong's stay in China, I think, that much better by introducing her to all these people. And then they became good friends. And Bernardine later moved to Los Angeles. So they continued to be friends there. And they were, the two women were also friends with Carl Van Vechten and Fanny Aminoff, who... Mm-hmm. Anna May Wong had a very long correspondence with. So they were kind of in the same circle together. And I think Bernardine, you know, understood Anna May Wong in a way that maybe other people didn't. herself having gone back and forth between the U.S. and many other countries and China, and being familiar with Chinese culture. But yeah, I mean, actually one of the things that Susan, you know, it was so great to connect with Susan because it can be lonely when you're a biographer, right? You're doing all this research and writing all by yourself. But with Susan, she, you know, we shared a lot of materials and she showed me some of the photos. So when, I'll just back up. When Anna Mae Wong was in Beijing, Bernadine went up and visited her first day. And together, the two women went out into the countryside because Anna Mae Wong really wanted to connect with just ordinary people there. And so there are these great photos of that Bernadine took of her speaking to these just regular Chinese farmers in the countryside. I would have never seen those. No one would have ever seen those if Susan hadn't written this biography about mm-hmm. Bernadine and, you know, found all those resources. So it was an amazing thing to find.
So I think with that, that's a great place to interview with K.G. Salisbury, author of Not Your China Doll, The Wild and Shimmering Life of Anna Mae Wong. Katie, I actually have two final questions for you, which are, where can people find your work? Not just this book, but all of your work. And what's next for you? What do you think the next project might be?
So the book should be available, well, I guess wherever books are sold. It's available as in the US as well as in the UK, and there will actually be a Chinese translation coming soon. It's in the works. And you can find me on my website, kdgsalisbury.com. All of my work lives there. You can follow me on Twitter, ksalisbury. I also write a newsletter called Half Caste Woman, which is generally about Anna Mae Wong or topics related to Asian American representation in media. So that's another place you can kind of stay up to date on things I'm thinking about or just events that are upcoming. And then in terms of like, what's next for me, definitely something I'm thinking about a lot right now. One topic that has, always been of interest to me and being a multiracial mixed person, something I think about a lot. So I am hoping to write about it in some capacity soon, but I'm not sure what form that's going to take, but we'll see.
Well, as a fellow hyphenated American, I look forward to hearing more about that. You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at Nick R.I. Gordon. That's NickRigordon. You can go to AsianReviewBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at Book Reviews Asia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author reviews at the New Books Network, newbooksnetwork.com. Follow some of your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those running in, around, and about Asia. Next week, joins an interview with Jeremy Garlick, author of Advantage China, Agent of Change in an Era of Global Disruption. But before then, Katie, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me.